Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
It's the big rugby few days. Welcome to the Weekend Podcast. Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last few days. On this episode, double Olympic champion Kelly Harrington, a Galway hurling legend on the highs and lows of playing county, the author who was inspired by a sleepwalking scare, and a preview of the rugby match of the year with a French chocolatier and a former Irish rugby player. First up, double Olympic champion Kelly Harrington. She came into studio for a catch-up. Now, I made the mistake of insulting her cardigan, which is very fetching and very cool. And despite the threat of violence against me, she did take it remarkably well. And we chatted about how she's enjoying her retirement, and she's fully retired at 35, learning to play the drums at home, and why she and her dogs would love to stay over at the Auras. It was a knockout conversation. Enjoy that. Then after that, another Harrington, this time Carmel Harrington. She's an author. She told us how her own child sleepwalking gave her the inspiration for her first thriller novel. It's a departure for her after 12 previous books. The Stolen Child is what it's called. And it's a romping good read. Carmel came to writing slightly later, but she kept going despite 47 rejection letters from agents. How could you? But it was a very warm conversation, and listeners got in touch with their sleepwalking ordeals in hotels as well during that chat. After that, you'll hear former Galway hurling legend Tony Og Regan. He came down to Dublin from Athenry. He's a very successful hurler for the county at minor and senior level once upon a time, and told us how his whole identity was wrapped up so much in hurling that when he was dropped from the team and lost his job in the same year, the year of the crash, he was thrown into a tailspin. But he fought his way back onto the Galway senior panel, made another All-Ireland final, and then changed his career to become a sports psychologist. And finally, we finished out the week with former Irish rugby international Fiona O'Brien, who maddeningly predicted a French win over Ireland with backing from a French fan living in Kenmare. He's a chocolatier. And we also discussed how Thierry Henry has stuck his hand into this rugby clash of the century. So enjoy the podcast. Into it we go. Harrington, welcome to studio. Double Olympic gold medalist. How are you?
All good, all good.
Is this a kind of like a colourful granny thing you're rocking this morning? A zippy cardigan?
I tell you, you're lucky I haven't got my gloves with you now, calling me a granny.
It's a compliment. I'll say on behalf of the grannies.
Someone get him a shovel, will you? He's going to keep digging here. I'm only joking. It's pink to make the boys and girls wink. I'm only joking.
You're in good form.
I'm always in good form in the morning. I'm a morning person. Now, about 3 o'clock today, I'll be like hanging together.
What's that Kelly like at 3 o'clock?
On the chair, probably stuffing my face with biscuits and stuff like that.
Too. I'll never believe that.
I'll have a little nap and then we get up and go again.
Do you have a little nap, a little chair nap?
Sometimes I do, yeah. I don't, whatever. See, I love getting up the crack of dawn and not watching the sunrise, but I just love there's a great feeling of when you're up early and you're rising with the sun, and I know that sounds
totally
really
agree.
Weird, but like.
Oh. And you, because you walk around town, as you told us the last time you were in here a year ago.
Yeah.
You strolled around, and I bumped into you in the city only last week.
That's right, yeah.
It's true. Kelly Harrington is just wandering around.
And I'd be walking around just looking up. I love walking around and looking up at buildings and the architecture of the buildings and stuff. And
really?
Just it's incredible, what? The man-made buildings, they're just absolutely amazing, and especially the buildings built back way, way back when, and if you actually just take time to walk around town, lift your head up, out of your phone and just look at what's in front of you, it's beautiful, it's absolutely beautiful.
You've won all the architects over. You'll be doing a speech soon before the architect. But it's also just a sign of that you love your city.
Yeah, I love it, absolutely love it.
And it's they need you. They need you to go around and tell people it's fine. It's a beautiful place to come because it's getting a lot of bad press at the moment. But never from your direction.
No, never from my direction. Look, there's bad stuff happening all over the world, We try to take the positives out of what we can each day and just go with that,
Also, no one's going to take you on.
No. They might now, though, if they see me in this granny's jumper.
It's very trendy. It's very trendy on you.
You have to say that now.
No, it really is. Although you did say you're taking a nap at the afternoon, so oh, full granny. Come here. When you won last August in Paris, which was extraordinary and brilliant, you immediately announced your retirement, basically. Are you still happy with that decision?
Yeah, I'm still happy. Like, I'm back out. I'm training with the team. I'm just training with the team.
Yeah.
Because it's what I've been used to doing for many years now. And I love being out there. Like, now I'm not training every day with the team. Like, I'm going in and out, like, just keeping fit. And just trying to basically pass on my experience and a little bit of knowledge that I have to other people. But I don't intend to. Yeah, I seen stuff like that was up that I was going to the World Championships in March, but I'm definitely not going to the World Championships in March. I'll be following the girls when they're out there, like, just like, you know, watching their fights online and stuff and seeing how they're doing, which I know they're going to do great because they've had great preparation and great camps. But I won't be there.
No. To what extent have you eased off the training then? Would you be fit enough to box if you wanted to, or are you...
That's a very good question. I'd be probably fit enough to do a minute and a half rounds instead of 3 minute rounds. But it's my body weight. So I'd fight at 60 kilos.
Yeah.
Now I'm 66 kilos. So I'm a stone heavier than what I was last year in August. I'm really, really happy and comfortable with my body. Like, it does take some adjusting to it, like, because your whole body shape changes, you know. You're not as athletic as you used to be. I'm still fit. I still go to the gym and it's just not as intense. But yeah, so my body weight is heavier, but I love my body. I love me curves. I love everything about it. You know, I just love being me and being able, not having to. So sometimes if, like, Jordan... my career, if we're out and we're eating or anything like that, you know, I'd always be kind of watching what I'm eating.
Of course, yeah.
And then I'd be thinking, right, what am I going to do now? Because, like, I've ate too much, I'm going to have to do something tomorrow just to counteract that, you know. But now I don't have to do that. Now I can just...
That's why you're having your biscuits.
That's it, you know what I mean? Biscuits at 3 o'clock in the day, where would you get it?
Much deserved, my gosh.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was long enough. The headlines from your last interview were, Kelly isn't fully closing the door on a return to the ring. So you're 34, aren't you? You were saying no. You were saying
35.
You're 35. Yeah, yeah. You were saying no, you're never going to go back into the ring competitively.
No, that's it. That's it. Done, dusted. Yeah, Paris, that last fight was the dance in the ring at the end of that was like, I can't believe I'm never going to be here again, you know? Now I miss it. Like, I do miss the feeling of... It's absolute madness, you know, and it's I'm allowed to be me true self, me true maddest when I'm in that zone. So I miss that, you know. I haven't been that mad now since last August, you know.
And but you got that moment.
I got that moment.
It was a beautiful moment, you dancing in the ring on your own, because you said you wanted to win this one for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And to go out like that, you know, like, I do think, like, personally, I could sit here and say, yeah, I'd love to go next year and I do think I could do it, but thinking you can do it and doing it is two different things. Like, I do think sometimes we don't know when enough is enough. Like, and enough is enough. I've done everything. Everybody keeps saying, you go for a third one, you know. And I'm like, oh, Janie. Like, I just know. Like, that's it.
I want my biscuits.
Yeah,
that's
I'm back on the biscuits, bro.
Categorical end. I was reading your book with Roddy Doyle. And after winning in Tokyo, you just went back to your, because it was pandemic times. It was a quiet celebration that night, wasn't it? What did you do in Paris? Because you were out and about the next day, weren't you, visiting was it a retirement home or somewhere?
Yeah, there was. So just literally outside, there's loads of different entrances in the village. But outside one of the entrances, there was a nursing home. And I had passed it by once or twice. And they had loads of stuff up, like, they'd done loads of paintings and they had the flags and the buntings out and all. So I just thought, you know what, like, it'd be nice to pop in there. So I popped in after, like, I think it was the day after I boxed. And I just brought the medal in. Now, they didn't speak English, but they know what a medal is and they know what the Olympics is because it's all happening, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just popped in and showed them, and they were just smiling, you know, they knew what it was. They didn't have a clue who I was, but they were, you know, they probably have never, some of them may have never seen or touched an Olympic medal before. So
yeah.
For me, I was delighted to be able to do that and bring that in and show them, and they got pictures and stuff with it. So
that was a
it was nice,
idea.
You know.
And it was fairly spontaneous, wasn't it? You just had yeah. seen it during your time in Paris.
Just walking by, just that was it, like just seeing it. And like, I just think like, when I'm that age and if I'm in a nursing home and if the Olympics is ever in Ireland, God, that's a big...
Oh, no.
But like, if there's ever anything like that, like, I would love someone to come in and show me their medals, you know. So like, that's the way I was looking at it, you know.
I know that's a gorgeous thing. And again, it kind of says that you observe things around you when you're wandering about, when you're walking.
Yeah.
Looking at the building. Somebody's text in here saying, Kelly is the president we need. Of course, you've turned 35 now. You're eligible.
I have no clue how to go for a president's role, but look,
we can fill you
I'm
in.
The president of Dublin One, and that's all that matters, really.
That's it. she's ruling herself out. Oh, yes, yeah. It's very boring for the whole year that we're going to ask every guest.
But I'd love to live in
this
gaff, though, I'm telling you now.
Imagine you'd like to live in the Oris.
Oh, the dogs would have an absolute ball up there.
Your publicist is right now going, oh my God, Kelly, no. You've just announced you're running. Yeah, my gosh, it is a place for dogs. After
oh,
all,
I tell
it?
You, the last time I was only ever up there once. What am I saying? The last time I was up there,
only there once.
I was only there once. Yeah, yeah. After Paris, we were all invited up. So
because of the pandemic, you couldn't go.
Went up and I tell you, they've some nice food. The cakes they had were unreal. And then the horses. We went down and had a look at the horses and the dog. We couldn't find the dog. The dog. We couldn't see him. But I was thinking. Imagine like living there and just having that all of that like space to let your dogs run
you
around.
You don't have to imagine, Kelly. Just say the word and we'll launch the campaign now.
No, but if the next president just invites me up for a week, I can stay there for a week even. Do you know what I mean? Imagine having a week's holiday up in the president's house.
That's game on. So you're offering your endorsement if you're not running yourself in exchange for a week's stay with the dogs, yourself and Mandy.
Living with the president.
So Linda Martin, President Linda Martin, who loves the dog, you will definitely welcome yourself and Mandy. Your two dogs, what are they called again?
Nidge and Gus.
Oh yeah, that's
Nidge
right.
And Gus, yeah, yeah.
And poor El Macy, but the ashes are there. And you still say good morning, good evening?
Every day, yeah.
Oh my
I
God.
Say, and sometimes I'll go up the stairs and I'll go, oh, forgot to say good night. And I come back down and I say good night. People think that's absolutely bizarre, but like...
They don't.
It's like, it's not that bizarre to me. It's she was me best pal, so just say good night and that's it.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Back to interviewing. So no offers. Well, there must have been offers to turn pro though that you would have turned down.
Well, there was, but
the money that's on offer there is extraordinary.
Look, you can have all the money in the world and be unhappy. You can have all the money in the world. And if you're not well in your head, like, what do you do with that money? Do you know what I mean? Like, I just think taking punches with small gloves and doing those longer rounds, it's not my cup of tea. I like having my head guard on to protect me. I like wearing the 10-ounce gloves that are a bit more padded to protect me. And my style of boxing is hit and don't get hit. And I've never tried to go to town on someone to try and look for the finish. I just do enough to get the job done and that's it. Like if I beat someone by a pint or two, I'm absolutely delighted with that. I don't need to be beating someone up, you know.
And you can be look back at your career and be absolutely happy with.
Yeah, very happy with it. And professional is just completely different. It's, you know, you're basically looking after everybody else. You're the money maker and everybody's making off of you. So... That's not my, it's a business and I'm not.
It's worked quite well for Katie Taylor though, hasn't she? She turned pro, obviously. I don't think she's contracted to do any more fights at the moment, but there's constant speculation about that Croke Park date maybe with Serrano. Do you think that would happen? Do you think she should wrap it up now? Have you any views on that?
No, like, I mean, at the end of the day, like, we're both two different people. So what she feels is good for her is good for her. And what I feel for me is for me, you know. So if she feels like she's fit, healthy and good to continue on, all power to her, you know. That's why not, like, you know. And yeah. It's something that she wants to do and that's what she likes. but it's not my cup of tea. So that's why I'm choosing not to do it, you know. But I wouldn't say, oh, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that, you know, because different strokes for different folks, really.
I mean, you've got all the diplomatic skills and everything.
This I'm telling you.
This is all pointing towards.
I could be a politician.
Hasn't ruled it out. Boxing is a sport in the Olympics, of course, was looking dodgy, wasn't it, for LA 2028? But looks like it might happen now. The International Olympic Committee, I think, have given provisional.
They've stepped in and
that's a big thing, isn't they're getting, it, for us?
It's not in at the moment, but they've okayed it and it will come in. Look, boxing will always be in the Olympics. You believe
it'll definitely happen?
Yeah, definitely.
This time last year it was a huge doubt, like even it was confirmed obviously for Paris, but the next one.
Sure, they were talking about it as well for Paris that it might not be in and it was in. And right. You know, someone like it, they always get the job done and it's good, you know.
Now, one of the things you are doing, you went back to St. Vincent's, didn't you? You've been working there part time as you had before.
Yeah.
Love that job still.
Yeah.
And you've kept at that. Now, another job you're doing brand ambassadorships left, right and centre. That's what you're talking about today.
Yeah.
Tell us about this community fund that you're helping.
So it's the Coca-Cola Thank You Fund, and there's a fund there of like up to 200,000 to be given out to community groups that supports young people.
Yeah.
And I'll back anything that's like that, you know, because obviously I'm coming from a disadvantaged community, Dublin One, and, you know, we're not that disadvantaged, but we have got our disadvantages in there.
Yeah.
And you know, I just like we were doing the campaign the other day and I got to meet a couple of the groups who had previously won. And it's just to see how the money helps them to grow as a group and as young people, as leaders. You know, it's fantastic what the money can do. And when we were doing the campaign the other day, I just was like, you know what, like my own club, my own boxing club, St. Mary's Boxing Club in Tallaght, needs to apply for this fund itself as well, because it's really, really great. Like you can, there's all kinds of things you can do. It can help with like nutritional skills, like weight making for different sports and stuff. And then like arts, music, it's all like
the homework clubs, all that sort of stuff.
All of it.
See,
the Irish
Youth Foundation are involved. They're a brilliant charity. Yeah.
But if you're
in
not
the north
in,
as well,
that's it. Yeah,
Youth Action Northern Ireland.
But you need to be in it you need to apply. You know, and like there's going to be thousands that are applying. You know, but you definitely need to apply to be in with a chance to being chose. You know, and if you do want to apply, it's coca-cola.ie/thank-you.
coca-cola.ie/thank-you, and the closing day for applications is Wednesday the 26th of March. They're offering grants of between 10,000 to 25,000 euro to help communities, and that's in its 15th year.
Yeah.
Kelly, so we've hit all the kind of points there now. There's loads of messages coming into you here now. There's nothing quite like Kelly's laugh to inject some positivity into a Monday morning. We should send her to talk to Trump. That laugh could soften any disagreement, says Peter and Mal Doyle. How much laughter out of Kelly Arrington might sort him out?
Oh, or I could just give him me ring walks there down. He'd be like, oh, Janie.
You can kind of give that pose. He'd be impressed by that. Any kind of show of force. Enough is as good as a feast. Wise woman. Kelly for president. What a breath of fresh air Kelly is. Such a heartwarming laughter.
Thanks very much.
Keep rising with the sun and lifting your head to appreciate what's right in front of you. A nice lesson for us all. It is actually. Lovely to hear from Kelly again. She's such a positive role model for our young girls. My 8-year-old daughter wrote her a letter after proudly watching her at the Olympics. Kelly sent her a card back, yes, and it still has pride of place in our bedroom wall.
Ah, oh, brilliant.
Thank you for
I'm glad to hear that.
You've done for Ireland and continue to do so. Do you get cards and letters from people?
I do. I get I always get cards and letters, and I do try to write back to them, you know. I just think if people have taken their time to send you a card or a letter, then you should try your best to write back. Now, a lot of them come in and they don't have addresses on them.
Oh, right.
But I do also, I love when people put their phone number on it, because I'll ring them up just randomly. Now, I always hide my number, you know.
The publicist is going to go, no. You can hide your number.
I do. Yeah, I do hide my number all the time.
And
I just ring them up.
Call from you.
Or a school will send me, schools are often sending letters, and they don't even put the address on it. They just put Kelly Harrington, Olympic champion, and it turns up at the house. But I love, I'll ring the school up and I'll ask for the student. And they'll be like, who is it? And then I tell them who it is. And they're like, What? I'm like, yeah, no, I got a letter and I just wanted to ring them and thank them. Like, it's random, but it's I just think it's deadly. Like, the kids That's are like, great. Oh my God, you know, like, it's...
That is great.
It's brilliant, like...
Like, that, it takes a time and effort to do that, so fair play to you.
But you know what? I'm never asked to do it. That's why I do it. You know, I hate being asked to do stuff and I'm like, okay. I'm not doing that. Someone asks me to do something, I'm very like, that's
you,
it.
You decide.
I'm not going. Dinner with my six self
Don't
at 6:30. I can't cancel that again. I'm like the Grinch.
What is this about you and a drum kit that Mandy, your wife, bought you for Christmas?
So Christmas morning, Mandy had said to me, right, I have a present. Now, she'd been telling me about this for ages, right? She didn't tell me what it was.
Oh, it was a surprise gift, okay.
It was a surprise. And I was convinced she was after getting another dog. And I wasn't happy, like, but I was like, this is like when I see it, I'm going to be happy, but I'm not happy right now, you know? So Christmas morning, she's like, right, come on, quick, come upstairs. And I was like, what? Like, because I thought it was going to be downstairs. And she's like, open the door. And I was thinking, has she had that in there all night, like with the door closed? And I opens the door and there's this like drum kit with the headphones. So when you're playing, no one else can hear you. Yeah. And I never played an instrument in my life. Like,
really? Well, so you know you can sing.
I give it a bash, like.
Yeah.
But I opened the door and when I seen the drum, I was like, oh, I've always wanted one of these. But I tell you, the crack you have with it, like, because you just put the earphones on, no one else. Now I did buy a speaker because I have to like,
it has to hear it.
The whole of Portland Row has to hear it, you know what I mean? The window's open, there's me banging out the drums. I haven't got a clue what I'm playing, but I can play a bit of U2 Sunday Bloody Sunday.
Oh, can you?
Yeah. And what else can I play?
So you're Larry Mulliniling hard.
I'm telling you, I'm like, but it's so like, so Mandy's
it would
really
be rhythm with boxing, obviously. So it has to be.
But it's so like your foot has to go as well because you have to like boom, boom, tch,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
boom, tch, like all this kind of stuff. But we had workers in last week and they were moving something for us in the house. And I was like, they were in that room. And the drum kit was here and like, oh, what's that? And I was explaining to them and they were like, oh, can you put the headphones on? I was like, I don't mind the headphones. Like, I've torn this up. And I'm in my pajamas, like, and Mandy's downstairs in the kitchen.
What an image.
And I'm like, waiting you to hear this. Tell me if you know what song this is. So I starts to play the U2 Bloody Sunday.
Did you? Already? You only got this at Christmas.
And yeah, and the two lads are like, oh, that's you too, Bloody Sunday, you know, like, yeah. And I'm bursting, like, I'm absolutely in a heap upstairs laughing because I know Mandy's downstairs absolutely cringe and going, I can't believe she's upstairs in the bedroom playing the drums for the two fellas who are doing a bit of work in the house. Like, I'm so embarrassed for her, but like,
you're PJs, but you just don't do embarrassment.
They need pajamas, like, no. Oh, I tell you.
You don't do embarrassment.
No, no.
come here, what else do I have to ask you? So we have to find out, you need a headline you see from all of these interviews. Will you do a high performance job in Sport Ireland or something like that? What will you do?
I haven't been asked to do any of those type of jobs, but I mean, if the opportunity arose, I would definitely explore it. But at the moment, like, I'd love to, like, I'm trying to start up a little allotment at the back of the house there and I'd love to have like some kind of coffee shop, like just to, so it's bring, I love bringing people together, like, you know?
Yeah.
So the Northeast Inner City and TU Dublin are doing they're starting up this program. They do it actually every year and I just seen it on their Instagram page and I was like, do you know what? I'm going to do that. It's a startup entrepreneurship program.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to go. Now, it's only on for 2.5 hours every Friday, but I'm going to partner down to that every Friday for 2.5 hours and
see what's going on.
Throw a few ideas around and see what we come up with
Kelly's,
down there.
Kelly's Cafe.
Do you know, I'd love to bring out a tea brand, Kelly's Tea.
Oh, are you into more tea than a coffee drinker?
Two sips and you're hooked. Or like Kelly's Tea. There's a real punch to it. Here, when we were over in Paris, me
you
and the
have
physio,
a lot about this.
We were when we were I in think. Paris, we were like literally like this amount of time you have on your hands. It's like, oh, I tell you, it's a real knockout.
There was another thing you were thinking about, which was a Paul O'Grady style show. The late Paul O'Grady did a great show on dogs, And did any offers come in through there? Because you put the...
Nothing has come in yet, but
that's because you announced.
No one takes me serious. Do you know what I mean?
Nobody takes
me serious, like, you know.
We do take serious. And by the way, you're a great presenter because you have co-presented before.
I met someone the other day, and I told them this is what I want to do, and I have this plan, and I told them about the plan about the for the love of dogs, but you'd have to change the name up and all because that was Paul O'Grady's.
Yeah.
And they said
for the glove of dogs.
For the glove of dogs, yeah, that's a very good one actually. So we said, look, if you get a phone call off RTE, don't turn it down. You know, don't block it, because that's what normally happens. I'm only joking.
Speaking of RTE, Jack Woolley is doing well on Dancing with the Stars.
Like he's
a friend of yours.
He's a friend of mine and Reese as well, you know. But honestly, what was his dance like to grace the Wolf Tones? Like, wasn't
right.
that just
I mean, that
amazing?
Was all of your dreams yeah. in one, wasn't it?
Yeah, just bawling my eyes out, you know. He's just, Jack Woolley is a phenomenal person. He's just really, really good. He's a good person, and it's hard to meet people like that.
Yeah.
And he's one of the good ones. And I love Jack because he is himself, mm-hmm. and he's never tried to be anything else other than himself. And he's not afraid to be himself. And that's what I love about him, you know. And
I can see kindred spirits. Yeah. But you were also the first person to get in contact with him when he was beaten up that time on the street.
Yeah, because I had been over in Tokyo with him, and he had lost over there, and I was chatting to him a good bit, and then we come home, and then when I'd seen that had happened to him in town, I was half raging I wasn't there when it had happened, but I just knew, you know what, like, that's a really low moment, because you're coming back from an Olympic Games and you're already sad, you know what I mean? Like, you're already down in the dumps because it didn't go as planned. And then this happens on top of that. So I just thought he needed a friend, and, you know, that's
the right person.
Yeah, that's what friends do. You know what I mean? Like, it's.
He's a great place now. I mean, we had him here a couple of months ago, and he's recovered from that. Although he'll point out the thing in his face, which none of us can see.
Yeah.
And he's doing a stormer on the dancing.
Yeah, I think there's two weeks left in it now, isn't it?
Goes to the Patrick's weekend. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. And it looks like it's Reese versus him, isn't it? It's Karoo.
Yeah, it's like, that's a tough one. Do you know, it is a tough one, but yeah, yeah. And I don't know what way it works. So what way does that happen? Like, will that still come down to voting, or?
It would be. It's voting and judges, isn't it? I can never figure out.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard. Like,
Kevin Dundon's gone anyway. That's the.
Yeah, yeah.
Grannies of Ireland be fuming away.
I'm saying nothing. I'm learning to keep my mouth shut when I should. You know what I mean?
I have to get to the rule everything out now. Dancing with the Stars for you.
That's done. Never doing that. Never doing it. They tried to poach me when I was in there. No, I couldn't.
If you want to do it, you'll show. You'll offer yourself.
No, I wouldn't do it. If they come up with some kind of like singing masked program, but although my voice, everybody, even when I sing, you can't miss my voice. Like,
you'll just laugh in the middle.
You know, like, that's it. Like,
masked singer. This is good crack as ever. Thanks a million for coming.
No, thanks very much for having me.
And good luck with the everything that you're doing, even though you've left the door open to Oris and Oaktron.
Thank you very much. And I hope all the listeners have a really great week.
Kelly Harrington, ladies and gentlemen. Carmel Harrington is in studio, and she is unstoppable. Welcome, Carmel.
Thank you.
Why is she unstoppable? Well, she had a secret ambition to become a writer for a very long time, and once she decided to make it happen, nothing was going to get in her way. The 13th novel is out today. Congratulations on The Stolen Child.
Thank you.
And it kept me in kind of like gripped there for a couple of evenings, so well done.
Oh, I love hearing that.
People are sending lovely things in about you already. Let's find out a little bit about you, Carmel.
Yeah, okay.
You had a series of jobs, or you were kind of in the normal world for a while.
I was,
Can
yeah.
I call it that?
I was. Well, I'm from Wexford, and I left Wexford at 18, very wide-eyed and innocent, to work with Aer Lingus.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and genuinely, I went to work for Aer Lingus because I wanted to see what was on the other side of the horizon. I always wanted to travel, and I figured that would be a great way of seeing the world for bargain prices. So I did. I travelled the world for 10 years with them. And I worked kind of in a sales role for them. So I ended up going to countries like Mozambique, South Africa,
wow,
Nigeria, the Philippines. So I was all over the world with them and kind of learned a lot about myself and about the world and different cultures during those years. And then I left them and I went into the private sector and I worked for an American multinational. Most people know them because they invented Post-it notes, 3M.
And I was
kind of in a sales role with them for another 10 years.
Sales roles which require a chatty persona.
Chatty persona. Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of, I travelled around Ireland for that. I wasn't in the air. I was on the road. And then I got married and met my husband, Roger, and we started a family. Mm-hmm. And while I was on maternity leave for my daughter, Amelia, who's now 15, I had already written 2 books, but I hadn't shown them to anyone. They were under my bed.
While on maternity leave, while looking after
her? No, I'd written them before.
Well,
that.
You had already written.
Like, I'd always wanted to write, Oliver, but I just never found the courage to kind of share it with anyone. I found it really difficult to say to people that I wanted to be a writer because I suppose you're kind of afraid of being judged. Mm-hmm. And also, if you say it out loud, then maybe you have to at least try. And there is that fear of failure and you never think that you're good enough.
Tough on yourself.
I was quite tough on myself, yes. And I always told myself, which I find hilarious now, that I was too busy to be a writer. And then when I had children and I got married, I have never been busier in my life, you know. And I really
that should be the impossible time.
It should have been the impossible time. And I used to write when the kids, in between naps, I would write. And in the evenings, I would write. And I would say now that I have a dodgy knee and it's because I used to rock the baby's rocker, you know, with my foot while I had the laptop on my lap and I would write words. So it was kind of like, I don't know how I did it, but I did it when they were, you know, I had 2 babies under 2 and I made the decision, okay, I'm going to really go for this and see if I can get...
The brain was firing away. The whole
brain
time.
Was firing away, yeah. I was very inspired, I think, by the kids, really.
This is the first thriller, is it? I
this is the first thriller.
What kind of novels have you been writing up to now?
Kind of family dramas. Now, they all have mystery and suspense in them to some levels, some more than others. But over the last few years, Oliver, I just found myself kind of lean into the dark side. I really enjoyed it. I don't know what that says about me, but I just really wanted to go for it. And then the idea for this book came to me quite a few years ago, actually, from a family horrifying moment.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to write. I knew I had to write this book. It felt like it was just the book that I needed to write. And I'm so glad I did. It was
a family holiday.
A family holiday in Florida. The kids were, Nate was 5, he's my youngest, and Amelia would have been 6 and a half. And the hotel was, you know, those hotels, the corridors are like The Shining, you know, Jack Nicholson's The Shining, the really long, narrow corridors.
Gigantic hotel.
Florida, yeah. And we were on the 5th floor. But I remember we arrived to the hotel and everyone was shattered because it's Irish time versus local time. Anyhow, so we went straight to bed. 1 bedroom, 2 double beds, 2 massive double beds, actually. I do remember that. So the kids were in one and we were in the other, but foot between the 2 beds. And then I woke up at 3 in the morning and heard a banging on the front door. And it was very funny because I went to open the door. My husband stopped me and he said, Carmel, we're in America. It's 3 in the morning. I'm ringing reception. Do not open that door. But I just got it into my head that Nate was out there. You couldn't hear him, but I didn't think it was Amelia, but I thought Nate was there, whatever mother's instinct you have.
And you just stumbled in the dark through the room.
Stumbled in the dark, yeah.
Half asleep.
And I said to Rog, that's Nate. And he said, don't be silly. Like, he's asleep in our bedroom. So he went back in to check on the children and I opened the door. And of course, there was Nate. And I could still see him. Like, he had this blonde curly hair and he was so distraught. He was sobbing and terrified and so relieved to see me when we opened the door. Mm. And then, of course, we were, you know, the terror. Why is he in the corridor in Florida in the middle of the night? Like, how did he get there? Why is he there? And we were so confused. He was confused. But to cut a long story short, we figured out, you know, with time that he'd begun sleepwalking. Of all the times to choose to do it, but in a hotel. I know.
So he just got up unbeknownst.
He got up in the night. The first thing he realised was he was actually at the lift, which, as I said, was at the end of this really, really long corridor.
Yeah.
And the lift binged and it brought him out of his sleep.
That woke him up.
And he was in his PJs, of course, and he was looking around him going, this is not, like, where's mam, where's dad? And he realised that he was in the corridor and he was so terrified. And he was trying to remember where the hotel room was. And I had said, luckily enough, when we were checking in and we got out of the lift and found our hotel room, I just said to the kids in conversation, we'll never forget which is our room because it's the last one at the end of this long corridor.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And he remembered that. And then, of course, he ran. So he said he ran so fast, but then he couldn't remember if it was the left or the right.
Oh, yeah,
door,
yeah.
You know, and he took a guess and he was right. But we were so terrified, and it began like for years. Every time we went on holiday, we would have to barricade all the exits so that there was a dining room table.
Sleepwalking meant he'd get up and open the door himself.
We found out, like, we went to the doctor, of course, and had him checked over and all the rest. And we found out, like, one in five children sleepwalk at that kind of age, but most of them don't do it again. But then some do it again. And Nate was one of those. He did it for years. We have so many stories, like family stories. And
did the doctor have any theory on why it would continue on? Or what?
He just said it was one of those things, and it's actually hereditary. He asked my husband and I, did we sleepwalk? We don't, had never. And then he said, either of you have night terrors? I have always had night terrors.
Really?
And he said, it's in the same family. And so, I don't know, I think it's because I have my imagination never stops. So it's even when
it's
I'm
the
sleeping.
The writer's brain, yeah.
I think it must be the writer's brain. And I think Nate has a writer's brain as well. He definitely has that imagination. And I'm not sure that's scientific now. That's just my own thoughts on it.
What age is Nate now?
He's now 13.
So he'd remember that.
He remembers it clearly. He remembers it clearly. And he said that he remembers me saying at the lift, you know, about the room being the last one. But he remembers being very scared and being afraid he tapped on the wrong door, you know, and the relief then when I opened it. But really what kind of inspired the story was, it was a few days later when I stopped crying. I mean, I cried for days.
I'd say you didn't let him go either.
No,
for the rest.
He slept with me. Roger was in bed with Amelia for the rest of the holiday and Nate was with me. And I just slept with my arm across him. He wasn't out of my arms for a long time. But it was actually Roger said to me a while later, and he said, look at Carmel, you know, if we'd slept through and he hadn't found his way back to our room, who would believe us as parents that we could sleep through a child leaving the same bedroom? You're sharing this small space. No one would believe us. And so they said, so Rog was saying, you know, they would immediately look at us. And then my husband said, actually, they wouldn't look at you, Carmel, because he said, you know, you would be so emotional. Everyone would never believe you could do anything, you know, to a child. And I was thinking, yeah, to my husband, you're so in trouble because he's so measured. He's the yin to my yang, you know, he'd be quite measured where I'd be quite emotional. Okay. I thought, yeah, poor Rog now, he would be the first one in the firing line. So that kind of was the inkling of the story. And I thought, wouldn't it be good to explore a story where a child disappears from a very small enclosed space shared with the parents? And then the reader would have to try and work out along with the parents as to what happened at the end of the book. So that was where the story kind of came from.
And this particular bedroom is on a cruise liner to make it extra terrifying.
Well, we did
what
a family
is wrong
cruise.
With you writers?
I know, I have a really bad mind. But you know, so many of my stories, though, they come from moments in my own life. And we did a family cruise. And if you ever do a family cruise, you'll know that you're in a very small space. Yeah. And I thought, this is great because now we're surrounded by water. So we're really adding to the mystery.
Nice locker
so
room.
I had a lot to play with then.
And Nate, your 13-year-old young fella, he actually came up with the idea, did he?
Yeah, he came up with the twist, actually.
And wicked twist.
A wicked twist as well, yes. The kids are both really involved in my writing. They always have. And I always tell them stories about the stories I'm writing. PG versions, right? So they don't get the dark. But I'll tell them and they get really invested. And every day after school, they will say, you know, Mammy, how many words did you write? You know,
they do. Reverse homework.
Yeah, they do. They keep me in check, which is good. So I feel I have to impress the kids. But seriously. But on this particular occasion, it was just Nate in the car with me. And he was saying to me, you know, what are you working on, Mam? And I told him I had this idea inspired by his sleepwalking shenanigans.
Yeah.
But I said I was trying to work out like the motivation for a character, which I can't say because it would be a plot spoiler.
No, yeah.
But the thing that's really important to me is that every book I write relatable characters that could be your family member. Mm. And while you might not do what the characters do, you can understand why they do them.
Yeah.
That's important to me.
Okay.
So I was saying this to Nate and then he said, what if? And he literally gave me goosebumps because his what if is actually the main twist in the book.
The twist that I now know, but we can't give away.
I know. It was so brilliant,
he came
right?
up with that.
He came up with that. I know. You know, he wants all of the money now. He's like, he's literally. But he got a new bedroom, Oliver. The kids both got a new bedroom this year.
He had to do a deal.
Oh, yeah. He got a teenage bedroom. He got an upgrade. A glow up, as they say.
Plus he writes a page at the end of the book as a, did, yeah, yeah. As a, in the acknowledgements part.
Thought it was only right.
So he's a budding novelist.
I think he is. Like, although now he wants to be an architect, actually. But he said for years it was a writer, but now... He's much more sensible.
Still write the novels on the side, fine.
That's what I said, you know. I said, go get a proper job and then you can try your hand at novels on the side.
Mind you, there is architectural fiction, isn't there? As in the kind of a device to, you know, map out a house or your locked room, wherever you're setting your thing. What would have his interest if he was writing a novel now? What would his 13-year-old brain
zombies? Do zombies?
I read that. I'm up for that.
Well, me too. And actually, you know, I'm often asked, you know, if you could write one book, and one of these days I'm going to, under a pseudonym, if a zombie apocalypse novel comes out set in Ireland, it's Carmel Harrington who wrote it. She's just not admitting it because it's my favourite genre to watch. I find it very comforting. Like, if I need a bit of a switch off from life, I'll watch a zombie apocalyptic movie.
Have you watched all of The Walking Dead?
Oh, from start to finish, 75
series.
Yeah, all of them. Oh, many times.
This is about the gratuitous violence that attracts you.
See, I don't look at that. It's the character development and the arcs of the characters.
That's true.
I love it. And the gratuitous violence. Yeah.
It's so cartoonish. Like,
it is.
By the way, there's your son. He still sleepwalks. And now, would he know?
Do you know what? He hadn't for years, but when he started secondary school, which coincidentally tied in with him getting his new bedroom, I mentioned. And we had a couple of incidences where he woke up before midnight. He didn't wake up. He sleptwalked, but he got completely dressed into his uniform and came down thinking he was going. And it was only when he walked into the sitting room to me, I hadn't gone to bed. It wasn't quite midnight. And he came in fully dressed and he was there. I'm so confused. What's going on? And he had looked, it was terrible. But we've had when he was sleepwalking as a kid, I shouldn't be laughing. It's not funny. But he used to walk into his sister's bedroom and she'd wake up in the middle of the night and she'd say he would be just standing in her bedroom staring at her.
Eyes open.
Yeah, eyes open.
It's
and
terrifying.
He'd have no clue. We would wake up some days. I mean, he was always sneaking into our bed, and I don't mean that, but we could wake up and he could be asleep on the floor in our bedroom, and then he'd go, "Why did you put me here, Mammy?" We'd be like, "Of course we didn't put you on the floor." He would just walk in and he could be anywhere. So he did a lot.
And is it the usual rule? Is it true that we shouldn't disturb a person if you see them walk into the
room? Shouldn't, yeah. We just gently bring them back and kind of just calmly bring them back and let them kind of fall back asleep again. It's usually about 4 or 5 hours after they go to bed, and that tracks, you know. And
that's the deep sleep time.
A deep sleep, and that's when it all happens.
The REM.
Yeah.
Someone's actually sent us in a message there, just listening about sleepwalking. My daughter regularly sleepwalks and talks. She's 25 and still does it. We've had scary times when she's left the house or the hotel room while on holidays. Normally she doesn't wake up. One time she woke up in the hallway of a hotel, couldn't remember what room, trying to get to the reception, went in the lift, couldn't use it, there was no key card, of course, one of those places. Tried to get to the stairway, couldn't get out, there was no key card. And fortunately, a while later, the cleaner and the hoovering helped her. It must have woken
That's
her up.
Terrifying.
Very traumatic, is literally what they're saying to us.
You see, it does happen, and you think it's a fantastical story, but honestly, this happened, and it's gone down in kind of lore in our family now, but we had to be very careful when he was small. He couldn't go on sleepovers, and when he'd go to his nan and granddad's. One of the things we found out when we brought him to the doctor was that typically it's when you're out of your own environment. So that tracked again. We were
in
Florida.
Is that right? Interesting.
Yes. Okay. And so you kind of had to make sure that he was only somewhere where he knew where he was. And that lady who just sent that story and her daughter was in a hotel.
Yes.
You know, so often it's hotel rooms. That's what happens.
Something to do with the displacement or the different
space,
whatever. Did you go on a cruise? Because it's obviously very pertinent to the story here.
Yeah.
Have you been on family cruises?
We did a couple of family cruises. Best thing ever to do as a family. There's something for everybody on a cruise and lots of entertainment. So the kids adored it. We did one to Bermuda and we did one around the Mediterranean, which is where this book is set in.
Went to the Bermuda Triangle.
We went to the Bermuda Triangle and didn't get taken. No, nobody took us. Actually, we went through that without a single sleepwalking incident. It was great.
Phew. That is the scariest place. Yeah. And so it's set in the 1980s and a time hops
quite a bit. There's three timelines, actually. The 60s in London, 1980s for when the child goes missing, and then, of course, present day when we try to work it all out.
Yeah, it's a good crack. A kind of mothering is the theme here, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
Very much so.
Yeah, I did like to explore that. And in particular, I wanted to explore how mothers wear, I think parents actually, not just mothers, but parents, we wear masks, don't we? So every day you wear a mask of some description. You don't want your kids to know if you're having a bad day. You try to make it all safe for them. But I think that in this particular case, it's to an extreme level that the characters are wearing masks to cover past traumas. And one in particular, and again, I won't say which, but one of the characters at the end, you know, the mask comes off and oh, yeah. all the secrets come tumbling out.
Dastardly doings are
Dastardly.
Uncovered.
I know.
Oh my God.
It was great fun writing them though, Oliver. Like, I really did enjoy
it. It's lovely that you get to write these now because you went through quite a lot of rejection.
I did.
Which is typical of writers, but I'm 47 is a lot.
I know. Some of those were actually still to this day, I haven't had an answer, but I take them as a no. I think at this point, 13 years, 15 years later.
It's much worse, I would imagine.
Yeah, it is. Because the way it was back then, I bought the writer's yearbook, which is like a Bible. It's this huge thing. And I would literally highlight whoever I was sending my query out to. And then I draw a line through it then when I didn't get a response or did get a response. And I just kept going. And I exhausted the Irish ones very quickly. Then I exhausted the UK ones and I like had chalked up 47 and I started on America then. And I got as far as B in America and an agent said yes. It was a great relief. Yeah, 47.
Just kept going.
I just kept going.
There must have been so many times you went, I'm going to give up.
Yeah, I kind of think, I'm not sure. I think maybe I was just so exhausted. I wasn't sleeping much because I had two babies under two. And I think maybe it was just pure stubbornness. And I just kept doing it.
What you can do when you're under pressure.
Maybe I was sleepwalking through it. I don't know. But I just kept doing it. But I did. I kept going back to it. And I had this thing in my head. I wanted to do it for my kids, which might sound a little bit cheesy. And I apologize. I don't mean to be cheesy. But I really genuinely had thought when the kids came along, I wonder what their special talents are going to be. And, you know, as a kind of a new mother, I really vowed to help them achieve whatever their life's ambitions were. And it struck me that I was a bit of a fraud because ever since I had been a kid, I had wanted to be a writer. Mm. I had already written these two books and had just hidden kind of this part of me. And I thought, right, I better now get out of my own way. And
that's why you didn't tell anyone along the way.
It was ridiculous, really, you know.
It meant you'd no one to back you up, though, when you were getting rejected so often.
Possibly. But you know, after...
your husband.
My husband was amazing. He was the first person that I really was very honest with and he was so encouraging. And I was very lucky I met him, actually, because he never let me forget when I said one day I'd like to be. And every day he would say, Carmel, we have to make this happen.
And you keep a couple of secrets here and there, don't you? What's this about you and the cigarettes?
What are you talking about? Are you trying to get me in trouble? What are you doing?
You're a writer. I think you might have said this somewhere before.
I must have.
Are we up on earth?
My kids are going to be
listening. Very sharp team here.
A long, 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 long time ago, in a previous life, Oliver Callan, I may have smoked, but I did. You know, when I was
strangely, you don't look like a smoker. You were ever a smoker.
I was. Like, do you know, and it was terrible, when I worked with Aer Lingus, like you were nearly encouraged to, you know, squeeze into your uniform a little bit easier.
Way back then.
Like it's 100 years ago.
But it was acceptable in society.
I haven't smoked in a long time. My sister actually dropped me in it with the kids because, of course, I tell them if they ever smoke, they are being, you know, sent out of the home in shame. But my sister let slip that I smoked once to my kids, which I'm still sore about. Yeah. So now, thank you, Oliver, for bringing that up.
But
again,
when you're giving them up, it's a kind of a theme of yours. When you're trying something, you don't tell other people. So you do it quietly and then announce it.
I did exactly that. I gave up smoking. I told nobody because I didn't want to have that thing where everyone would say, oh, you're in a bad mood because you're smoking. You know, the way you were kind of looking at it.
Are you still off them? Constant.
Yeah, constant. And it was ages after I'd given up. And my dad actually said, you're not smoking, Carmel. And I went, I've stopped. I was so smug. I was delighted with myself. Yeah.
That's a really good approach. Yeah. Don't tell anyone what you're
at. My top tip. Tell nobody. Yeah.
Kind of surprise rather than disappointment.
I think so.
Really work
out. Yeah.
Now, you're in a lovely community of writers. Catherine Ryan Howard, friend of the show, has given an amazing recommendation for this.
She's my bestie, yeah.
Because she does twists herself.
So I was very nervous. And she was the person actually, when I came up with the whole plot for this story and I met her for coffee and I said, I've got this idea. What do you think? And she said, that's a thriller. And I thought, I know. Am I allowed to write a thriller? Am I allowed to join your murderous clan? And she thought
deeply and darkly about it.
Yeah, she did. But she when she heard the twist, she said to me, if you don't write this, I'm going to write it. So I thought, OK, well, that's totally
a good recommendation.
Yeah. So it was really, but I felt like...
Wait, the writers tell each other the big plot of something they haven't
only, there's only two. Hazel Gaynor is New York Times historical novelist. She's incredible. And she's the third one in our particular gang. We have a very small gang, but they're the only two people I would trust. But I would 100% trust them, and I do. So both of them would have known.
Do you read each other then?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we are.
Have you read Catherine Ryan Howard's name?
I have, and it's incredible.
It's good. I have too.
I know. Yeah, have you read it? Yes, it's really good, isn't it? She's got
Can't say anything about it.
She's dark and clever, you know. There's just a deadly combination, you know. But yeah, they're great fun actually. The two
really good fun, like yourself, Carmel.
Yeah, we do. Carmel, you have to. We work hard and play hard. So we will always we do these. We just had a Galentine's lunch.
There's I can see that.
Yeah, the three of us, and we literally were there, and we bought presents for each other. It's ridiculous. It's not long since Christmas, and we did presents, but we are very nice to each other. We love each other, and we do celebrate and also work hard together as well. Yeah.
You work hard because like the end of the book is like, well, here's the one I've written for next year.
Isn't that great? I know. I do like to. Yeah, I have to. I have to try and, you know, overachieve. You know, I've always been a bit of an overachiever, but yeah, no, the Nowhere Girls will be this time next year. So I'm very excited about
that.
What
do you do to unwind? Do you watch silly frippery on television?
I do. I love a Netflix series, I have to say. So
I'm being attacked for being anti-Meghan this morning. Would you be? Are you a pro-Meghan person?
Do you know what I love watching shows like that? And it's the same with, like, say, the Martha Stewart series on Netflix. Yeah. It's like a character study. So I watch it and I literally watching it with a writer's mind going, these are brilliant characters to include in books. And I'm going to watch it. And I think the way I see it is that a lot of the things that Meghan Markle is going to share in that series will not be attainable for most of us.
Right.
But there'll be one or two little bits. Like I do, I have to say, I saw her saying that she likes to put her condiments in bowls. I would like to put my condiments in bowls, I have to say. I quite enjoy that. You know, I like to make food look nice.
Yeah.
So maybe I might
I'd be like, do you have to scrape the mustard that wasn't used back into the little jar and is it tainted now?
Only at Christmas though. You know, you do those fancy things when the guests come over. Not for every day for, you know, for tea at six.
I hate to, you know, say that this might be biased for you, but you are wearing a necklace that says Notions.
I know.
And maybe this is why you love Meghan, because she's proud of Notions, isn't she?
Yeah. But you know what Notions are? Like Notions are the actual definition of Notions, aside from the use we do in Ireland. But Notions are those embellishments that are put on clothes. So years ago, you'd go to a dressmaker and you would bring your good tweed coat and you would say, I would like some Notions. What would you like? Maybe pearl buttons, maybe a nice collar. So if you go into a haberdashery store, there's a word for you.
Beautiful word.
You go to the Notions section.
Oh my God,
and that's where all of the that's where all of the buttons and all the lovely things are. So Notions are about making the best version of yourself. That's how I see it. So when I talk about having Notions, I want to be the very best version of Carmel Harrington that I can be, whether that's as a novelist, as a mother, as a wife, as a friend, you know, as a daughter.
You mean it as a compliment? That Catherine Ryan Howard, she's full of Notions.
She is. I told you, she is. She's a clever Notionist. But no, I do love the word Notions. And I think that for years, I saw it in a negative context. And I was like, I can't have Notions. Therefore, I better not write a book because people might think I have Notions. I know if I was to say, like, I can remember after my first book was published and was a bestseller, I met my a school friend who I hadn't seen in years. And she said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a stay-at-home mum, because I thought if I said I was a novelist or an author, she'd think I'd have Notions. So now I...
You're owning it.
Yeah, my daughter says, say it with chest. I say it with chest. I'm a novelist. There you go.
And another sleepwalking message here. Once on holiday, once in Budapest, in a top-class hotel out of season, I woke up having left my bedroom in the middle of the night. I noticed the corridor door closed behind me and lock. The only choice was to go to the rather grand reception. Unfortunately, I wasn't wearing any clothes.
What?
Rather embarrassing, says Craig.
That's actually really bad.
But again, it's out of their usual location, and that's where this.
I have a tip for Greg. If you sleepwalk, always wear pajamas, Greg. Like, I mean, come on, rookie error there now.
What if taking your pajamas off is part of sleepwalking? I want to finish with some lovely messages to you. Hello to Carmel. New Carmel from Aer Lingus. Great girl. Love from Breda, who's former Aer Lingus.
Oh, wow.
And that writer is just a joy to listen to. Like the new Maeve Binchy. Can't wait to read her book, says that one, which is called The Stolen Child, published by Headline and in all good bookshops and libraries now as well.
Thank you.
Carmel Harrington, good luck to you and the novelist Nate. We look forward to the zombie architectural genius thing that emerges.
One of these days, yeah.
But in the meantime, enjoy all the crack you're having with The Stolen Child and mind how you go.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, my next guest made the Galway senior hurling squad and got his first All-Star nomination. All of his dreams have come true. Life is perfect. But of course, Things go wrong. He's dropped from the panel, lost his job, but still he fought his way back into the team, made another All-Ireland final, then changed his career and discovered what was really important to him along the way and crucially how to enjoy everything that he was doing. Now he wants to share all of that wisdom that he's learned. Tony O'Regan, welcome into studio.
Thanks for having me, Oliver.
You're good and rested because you have a busy house at home, I gather.
It was nice to come to Dublin last night and get a night's sleep for the first time in a couple of months. We have two kids under two at the moment, so it's quite interesting, I'd say.
Joyous exhaustion. Is that the best way of putting it? Not even admitting that much. Whereabouts is home, by the way, over in the west?
We're living in Athenry at the moment. Oh. I originally grew up in Ballybeg in Rathoon.
Is that a good bit away then?
I know, about 15-20 minutes without traffic of Galway City.
It's a whole other story. And you grew up obviously surrounded by sport, various sports. Your parents were high achievers, both of them.
Yeah, I suppose Dad was a director of sport in UCG for nearly 40 years. My mother was a keen badminton player, as she liked to remind us. She won a couple of All-Irelands at that before we ever were successful. So, I was definitely very unfortunate with the environments I was in, be it in school or my community or the college I went to, or obviously been born in Galway as well. There was loads of opportunities from a sports perspective to develop your potential. And, you know, I had a certain amount of ability, but been fortunate enough to be around such great people in terms of my parents and coaches that allowed that to get to a next level in terms of playing intercounty.
And in East Galway, you're born with a Camogie in your hand, really, aren't you?
Yeah. I suppose within Galway City, there's loads of sports. Obviously, we have a professional rugby team in Connacht and then the Gaelic football and hurling side of it, and, you know, a lot of athletics as well. So, multi-sport.
It's amazing city, in the fairness, success and that they have, considering the pool it's coming from with all of those.
Yeah, like you, we're probably one of the most successful counties in terms of the Gaelic, with the ladies in terms of Gaelic football and Camogie as well, and the amount of Olympians we've produced as well. So it's a very vibrant county in terms of sports people and successful sports people.
Come here, when you're growing up and you're playing hurling as a young fella, is the pressure really bad as well in underage level from your memory of it? Because we know what it's like then when it gets to the senior championship and the elite end of things.
I suppose it's all our perspective at times, and definitely I was a person who probably put myself under extreme pressure at different stages of my career, and I chronicled that in the book, where maybe a minor final at 16, I'd got injured going into the lead into it, and all I could focus in on that I'd missed 3 weeks training rather than the 47 weeks I'd done, and ended up being very anxious and worried going into that first All-Ireland final. It was in Croke Park. There was redeveloping, I think, the Hogan stand or the Cusick stand at that stage. So there was only going to be 50,000 at it. So for a 16-year-old, building up to that for a week, it did cause a lot of anxiety and worry for me. And I didn't play to my potential in that game. And I remember breaking down afterwards, crying, feeling that I'd let myself down and let my family down. And Dad coming into the dressing room and Crow Bart to console me, however he managed to do it. But, it was just an early experience that maybe, what the mind can do when you're maybe focused on things that aren't helpful to your performance.
You're overwhelmed, basically.
Yeah.
And of course, you only know now, looking back, that you were a child at the time.
Yeah.
Do you remember, did the consolation work? Did he carry it along with you, the pain of not going well for weeks afterwards as a teenager?
No, I think I was able to set it aside fairly quickly, back into school maybe the Tuesday after the match, and you move on fairly quickly. But I knew there was a determination in me that I wanted to get back there in my next year minor again and play a lot better in a final, and thankfully I did. But it did come up for me again maybe at 19 playing an 1-2-1 final, where again missed a number of weeks preparation and just taken off after 20 minutes in the All-Ireland final again, and come back into college.
Was this
college
in senior?
No, under 21.
Oh, under 21, yeah.
Yeah, but 3 years later, and the same kind of emotions came up, and I kind of realised at that point I'm not handling All-Ireland finals well, or is it bigger important match as well, and I didn't really know what to do with that self-awareness at that stage either, because there wasn't that people around to help you, I suppose.
And then at senior level, you're in that 2005 final that Galway lose to Cork. What was your head like at that time? It must have been in a good place then.
I suppose the year previously we played in a National League final, which we'd won. And again, the National Final thing probably got to me a small bit again, and I got taken off after 20 minutes. So I just realised, maybe looking back at the book, I didn't really have any, if I didn't start well in certain situations, I probably didn't have a great mental recovery to respond to that, and would go off and go into, my inner critic would take over, and you're playing useless and you won't be taken off and you're letting everyone down. I just go on this kind of negative negative thinking cycle. 2005 was a lot better, where, you know, I seemed to start matches well and I was fine, and we got to the All-Ireland final and was nominated for an All-Star. And, you know, probably things changed then. You had a management team for 3 or 4 years, Conor Hayes, and he left. And, you know, a new management team came in, and, you know, they had a different environment where, you know, you probably didn't feel as trusted in terms of selection, and your opinion maybe wasn't, you know, asked for, and you felt like maybe a number on the panel.
But they're doing things differently, aren't they?
Yeah, everyone does.
They
yeah.
have their own reasons for it.
We've all experienced that maybe in sports or a work environment where management changes, and everyone has a different approach, and, you know, we all respond to different things. And, you know, I definitely found that environment I had for the previous 4 or 5 years was, you know, more helpful for me to get more out of my potential.
You played better, you feel, under there, and it kind of unravels then, and you're dropped from, and it's just 3 years after a final.
Yeah, so like 21, I'm, you know, starting my first week as a chartered accountant in Galway at THK. I had the option of doing a master's in economics that time, or starting in the bank, or doing the chartered accountant route, and I decided to do that. And I'm playing my first All-Ireland senior final, and, you know, life was mapped out for me for the next 3 years, really. You know, routine, a schedule, you know, I was, you know, hitting a lot of the markers that I wanted to hit in terms of my life goals. And then, you know, 3 years later, it all kind of unraveled for me. I felt maybe that environment I was in from a sports perspective, I burnt out from it. I was trying to manage professional exams, been a sports person, and, you know, I failed my final exams. My form and injuries just started to happen for those 2 years playing with Galway, and, you know, I got let go from the squad. And, you know,
How did you find out?
I got a letter from the county chairman, which is quite hard. I know a new management team was coming in, but, you know, it would have been nice to have a conversation with that new manager just
to see. Literally a physical letter.
Yeah. What I could have done differently, or what I could have worked on, or, you know, why I was being let go in terms of X, Y and Z. But just to say a letter that you weren't part of it, you know, it was hard to contend with. And, you know, I probably knew I'd failed my exams as well, and my contract and work was going to be finished, you know, a couple of months after that in February, and we're in an economic crisis as well. So
2008.
Yeah.
You know what happens in September.
It was a very searching time in terms of, you know, I'd seen myself as the athlete and sports person. You know, I'd seen myself as an accountant, and now, like, who the hell am I? Like, I've no job. I'm not on the Galway senior team, and, you know, there's no real part-time work around or whatever. And, you know, you do ask the deeper questions around what's your life for, and why you're here, and what's your purpose. And, you know, chapter one, my book, kind of goes into depth in this, in terms of, you know, clarity versus confusion. And you know, I had tied a lot of my self-esteem and self-worth into playing with Galway and my happiness, and probably tied a lot of it to being successful in my job and getting my exams and being an accountant. And, you know, when they're taken away from me, you have to kind of look at yourself and say, like, what is success for you now, and what do you want to stand for as a person in terms of your values, and, you know, what's your purpose now? And chapter one and two, like, really lean into that for people, that, you know, we can perform a role in terms of work, or we can perform a role in terms of sport, but it's not at the essence of who we are. And I think we all need to sometimes create that separation and not make all our identity about one thing.
I want to talk about that period again in your life, in your early 20s, because it's a real insight into kind of the young male brain, which you're not, probably not articulating a lot of these feelings at the time. You go on the dole, and that really, you feel very shameful about that at the time.
Yeah, because, you know, I felt on top of the world 3 years previously, where, you know, your 21st birthday, you have a lot of friends around you, you know, you're nominated for an All-Star, you know, you're starting your first job, and, you know, a salary and all those aspects, and, you know, life feels really good and it's mapped out for you. And then, you know, I've no one ringing me to offer me a job. I'm not in the Galway senior team. No one's offering me an option there.
Are you still in touch with the players? Because they would be your circle of friends.
Yes, a certain amount. But part of you wants to detach from that because you're heartbroken. And it's like, you know, you break up with a girl. You don't want to see her either, because...
And it feels
like
that.
Yeah, it feels like that kind of, you know, relationship broken, and a bit of heartbreak around it. And, you know, you probably isolate yourself from certain people and conversations because you really don't want to talk about the team, or, you know, because you feel, you know, from 13 years of age to 24, Galway hurling was a part of my life. And that separation after 10 years, it's a breakup, like, and you don't know where to turn, really, in terms of, I felt I had a lot to give and I wanted to get back there. And that's what a lot of the book is about as well, in terms of how I rebuilt myself to do that.
But that is, it's called MVP, Raise Your Game, Unlock Your Potential. And it's coming from that position you were in, which you end up going back to live at home as well. Not unusual now, but it would have been at the time, because you've been living away, you've gone through that rite of passage. What happens? How do you pick yourself up from there?
Yeah, listen, I think the month or two at the start, you know, February, March, April, when you have no work, you have no training routine with the county, you know, I was lost and a bit lost for 2 or 3 months there. And you're a bit, you know, in denial about what happened. You're maybe hoping a call will come for work, hoping a call will come from the county management. And you haven't really decided what your new routine is. So, you know, I had to kind of take control of that and say, right, I can't be waiting on people to offer me work, or I can't be waiting on people to, you know, call me back into the Galway senior team. I have to do some work myself to make that happen.
It dawns on you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I knew I'd have exams coming in August, so you could set a plan in place in terms of how we're going to study for that. And, you know, I could set a plan in place in terms of how I was going to get back in with Galway. And, you know, I lean into many professionals in terms of spring coaches and nutritionists and S&C coaches to help with the Galway side of things. And, you know, leaned into people within the work environment to say, right, how do I navigate this next piece in terms of passing my exams? And, you know, thankfully things started to take shape and I had a bit of a routine. And, you know, by the end of that year, I was very proud to say I passed my exams, got called back in with Galway, and, you know, got a job the following January as well. So, you know, from that very dark
place.
Which
is incredible, by early 2009 to get a job in the crashing economy that was happening. And then a year later, you're back where you belonged.
Yeah, it was a really, really, you know, kind of Cartesian moment for me in terms of been back in with Galway and been on a bus to going to Croke Park again and playing in All-Ireland quarterfinals and Leinster finals. And, you know, it was really, really, I think I never took for granted playing with Galway, but, you know, I was really coming from a place of gratitude now rather than fear playing these matches and the privilege of it. And
it's a totally different attitude.
Yeah, and same from a work perspective as well. I'd obviously worked in practice for nearly 4 years, but now I was working in industry and it was a whole different world for me as well. And, you know, I just really was really grateful for that year in particular, and, you know, my life kind of been rebuilt again from scratch.
That's 2010, but you must have been on the bench though, were you, initially? Did you have to?
I was told I was fourth choice, all right, in terms of starting in the position, but I got a little break at the start of the year in terms of playing the first kind of Walsh Cup. And, you know, from there, you know, I held my position for the rest of the year and got, you know, named vice captain by the manager at the end of the year and was nominated for an All-Star. So
incredible.
Yeah, no, it was a really, really positive turnaround, and just showed with, you know, a bit of belief and a plan what you can achieve.
Galway made the final in that year, 2010.
2012 we made the final, yeah, yeah.
And so you were still there.
Still there, thankfully. Yeah, we won our first Leinster title that year as well, and in the county's history. So, you know, that's
it. It was only 2-3 years earlier, I think, was it 2009?
Yeah, we joined Leinster, yeah. So that was a really positive experience and something I really enjoyed.
And you're back, everything is going good in the career as well?
Yeah, I suppose what would happen then for me, I suppose my second kind of change was my inter-county career finished in 2013. Again, not by my own choice. I was 29, 30 years of age and felt I had a couple of years to give. And
it seems, you know, young, yeah.
It comes at a bit of a shock again.
Were you seen as being spun out, or what was the...
I just was told maybe I'd lost a bit of form that year and they were looking at younger fellas for the season ahead, and that was it really. And, you know, you don't really have any position of power to argue your case at that stage. And
having gone through that before, were you better equipped this time?
I was and I wasn't, Oliver, because, you know, part of me was saying, you know, the manager's going to be in place for another 2 or 3 years and he's the one that's dropping me now. And, you know, do I have the energy to go training on my own at that level again to try and prove a point to a person that had probably seen me for, you know, the last 10 years playing with the seniors, like, you know. So it probably did make me look at, right, what's the bigger life picture for me now as a person? And, you know, I hadn't been entirely happy in my career as an accountant at that point. And
not fulfilled.
I had started working with a life coach for Anna O'Reilly through the Gaelic Players Association at the start of 2013. And, you know, that really did help me navigate that change in terms of going back to college again at 29, you know, telling my parents maybe I was thinking of changing career. And it did take 3 years in terms of doing a certificate and a master's. And, you know, I've gone on and done life and executive coaching and leadership development training as well. And, you know, that's the space I wanted to head into in terms of high performance coaching and health and wellbeing coaching.
You had a rough time as well around that time, leaving the intercounty panel. Some friends lost their lives to mental illness, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I suppose 2011, I was coaching in my club with an underage team, and we had a really special young fella, Andrew Rogers, who were coaching at the time, and he was 14, 15, and, you know, decided to take his own life, you know, with a surprise eyes for all of us. And, you know, he was such a bubbly, energetic young man. And, you know, he was such a caring young man and respectful young man. And, you know, it was a huge surprise for us all. And, you know, it really caught us by surprise. And, you know, you're questioning yourself. And during that period, what did you miss? Or, you know, what could you have done better? And, you know, it's probably led me to, you know, what I'm doing now. And then obviously losing Niall Donoghue at Galway in 2013 as well was such a surprise, even though we knew Niall was struggling.
A teammate as well.
The two of us probably had played side by side in 2012 in that All-Ireland run, and 2013 both of us were probably struggling internally off the field, and we didn't really fulfil our potential on the field. So we sat alongside each other a lot on the bus and, you know, on the dugout that year as subs. And, you know, Niall would have been expressing to me the difficulty he was having at different times that year. And, you know, unfortunately, we got knocked out in July that year with Galway, and Niall is living in South Galway and I'm in West Galway, and we probably didn't have that interaction four or five times a week. And then, you know, he's back with his club and I'm back with my club. And, yeah, unfortunately, he took his life then that October. And, yeah, it's been, you know, you'd always think of these people on a regular basis and, you know, how their families are coping, etc.
Yeah, the devastation for the immediate families. But what does it do to you in your head as a friend? Because it has such a kind of a shockwave all around the community, doesn't it?
It does, like, and like, we tried to remember Niall as best we could last year with the memorial match. We had, you know, raised nearly, I think, 40,000-50,000 with Jigsaw for youth mental health services. And, you know, it's great to think that Niall's legacy will help with that and help younger teenagers and adolescents in that area in particular.
Conversations
and
massively improved.
Yeah, because, you know, even within a sports environment or a work environment, you know, it's not a stigma anymore to be say that you're suffering from, you know, a mental health issue or you need some help that you're struggling. And I think that vulnerability is starting to come through a lot more with people in conversation. So, you know, the likes of Jigsaw and other mental health services are vital now that we remove that stigma and get people support.
And I want to mention that support is there as well on rte.ie/helplines at this point. So it's a difficult time for you. Are you bitter when you're watching? Because Galway are doing really well at this stage, aren't they? Into, is it 2015? Do they make a final?
Yeah, and I suppose
you're no longer
going part back of to it. College for me was a bit of a healing process for that, in terms of, you know, here I can add value in terms of working with sports people or business people in terms of their health or well-being or high performance. And I did a thesis around career transition and retirement, and, you know, from that you kind of learn some people can take, you know, 6 weeks or 6 months to come through that transition period or change. Others take up to 3 years, and I definitely felt that. And I remember sitting at the All-Ireland final in 2015 when the seniors were playing and we had won the minor previously that day, and I was working as a sports psychologist with them. And you know, just feeling heartbroken that Galway were 4 points up at half time, and I felt like I wanted to leave the stadium because I felt I was going to miss out and you know, not been in the group and playing with the group. And my heart was going to burst with sadness. So I knew at that point I hadn't really dealt with it or recovered as well as I could. And you know, it took a couple of years and working with different.
Did you feel guilty at the relief when they didn't win that day?
Listen, it's such a weird thing to say, you know, the team that you love playing with and a county you love playing and a game you love playing, that, you know, you would have been heartbroken if they won just because you're missing out yourself. Like, and that was such a weird emotion to be feeling, because since I was 9 or 10 years of age, I wanted to go between all Ireland's and want to be a part of it. So I didn't know what was happening internally and why that was. And, you know, it was the heartbreak of not being part of that setup and not being able to experience those joyous moments with friends, like real lifelong friends. Like, and, you know, it probably took me another 2 years to realise that I'd healed from that when I won the All-Ireland in 2017. And you're out in the field, you know, jumping with the senior lads after the minors had won. And I was working with the minors, and it was great to meet past teammates and friends and share that moment with them, because I knew how hard some of them worked for 10 or 12 years to get to that point. And as
you were
a county,
healed at that stage, were you?
Yeah, absolutely. It was just completely joyous, the whole aftermath of the match and the homecoming and everything, and being able to share those moments with them, you know, for 2 or 3 days was fantastic. Like, for
first All-Ireland in your lifetime, really. I mean,
it really was. Like, I know 87, 88 was the last time, so it was only 5 or 6, so your memories of that are vague. And obviously I've seen the footballers win in 98 and 2001, and they were great memories.
So you do this big career change and a master's, and this is what you do now. You're a sports psychologist.
Yeah, yeah.
Who have you been working with in the last few years?
Yeah, the last 10 years, I suppose, you know, started with the Galway Minors in hurling, and then it led to the Galway Senior Footballers for 5 years under Kevin Walsh, and Waterford Senior Hurlers, Tipp Senior Hurlers, Limerick Senior Hurlers, Offaly Senior Hurlers, Ballygunner Senior Hurlers, Uachtaráid Footballers. And, you know, we've been lucky to win national finals and All-Ireland finals with a lot of those groups, and, you know, some great memories and friendships have been massive along the way, and you know, it's really opened up the whole country to me, to, you know, different people and different cultures. And
you're able to celebrate Waterford teams
and so on.
He's definitely healed, that's for sure.
Waterford has been a great place for me in terms of changing my life around, going to college down there in Waterford IT, and obviously winning, you know, multiple national honours with Ballygunner as well, and creating lasting friendships. So it's a place that's very close to my heart.
I hope you're helping the Daisha out as well. They're very sore down there many years. To touch on the experience you've had, have you spoken, has the GAA improved in how, you know, fellas are dropped from teams, and what you talked about, the devastation of being separated from friends and the bitterness and the grudges that can eat people up?
Yeah, listen, I think the transitions that's happened now since I started out, you know, particularly with the Gaelic Players Association, is that, you know, there's the support around being a student athlete, and, you know, obviously they're high risk in terms of mental health as well, because there's a lot of multiple demands that I experienced in my early 20s around that aspect. You know, players leaving the game as well, how that transition is managed as well, and you often see the likes of county boards and management making statements recognising the value and contribution of players, and you can do a transition programme through that as well. And
massive improvements is the word,
and even
much needed.
The work environment as well, Oliver, obviously, you know, workplace well-being, you know, leadership training and all those team development things that I do now as well, and the one-to-one coaching, you know, they are very normalised now within work environments, that people have those resources to help them navigate the obvious challenges that life brings for us all.
MVP is Book of the Month on Easton, so selling well, and I hope you're managing your delight and allowing yourself to enjoy the moment. If you have 30 seconds, what would your lessons be for people on this story, on the MVP, the book?
Yeah, I would hope that this book would give you, you know, real clarity in terms of who you are, what you stand for. It will allow you to, you know, focus on what you're good at in terms of your confidence and your ability. And it'll help you to recognise maybe some of the fears that you have, and able to overcome those fears in terms of getting the best out of your potential, whether that's from a personal point of view or professional point of view or sporting point of view. And that's what my book wants to give, is just those key principles to people to navigate, you know, the multiple lives that we do have, the multiple senses of selves, and, you know, to get the best out of your potential.
Enjoy the whole thing.
Yeah, in a healthy and sustainable way, because I probably done it too much the other way where I caused a lot of mental distress for myself.
It'll be helpful for the men and women out there. Well, Tony O'Gregan, thanks a million for joining us. We'll have to get back to your family. There's a Harry Og. You have a Harry Og?
Yeah, Harry Og.
How does Tony Og end up with Harry Og?
My wife's father is Harry, so we decided to keep the tradition going.
I see. Okay,
I put my Og in there just to keep our side of the coin.
MVP, as in most valuable player, that's taken in from American football. MVP, Raise Your Game, Unlock Your Potential by Tony O'Gregan, out now from Hachette Books. Tony Og, thanks a million.
Thank you, Oliver.
Safe home. It is the rugby clash of the century. Ireland take on France tomorrow. It's at 2:15 on Lansdowne Road. What's at stake? Well, our fifth Grand Slam and the first 3-in-a-row title win ever. No one has done it since the late 80s, when France did 4 in a row in the Five Nations, but two of those were shared, so no one's done 3 in a row on their own. You can feel the anticipation in your very chest. Ireland captain Caelan Doris, he's been past fit to start tomorrow, and Mac Hansen, though he's out through injury, we still don't have Tadhg Furlong, and Gary Ringrose is suspended, so it's on a knife edge. I'm going to talk to Fiona O'Brien, Ireland Rugby International. I think she's on the line. We're going to come to a French fan shortly, but I'm joined by Fiona O'Brien. First of all, welcome back, Fiona.
Well, thank you very much. Oh, good morning.
There is very nervous excitement about this match.
There is. Listen, it's been touted as the title decider, and at the moment, Ireland are slim favourites. But as we learned when we spoke last year, Oliver, where I predicted Ireland would have absolutely no problem squatting England and Twickenham, the beauty of sport lies in its inherent unpredictability. And look, that's why we tune in. And I think ultimately this game is just so difficult to predict. And I'd argue, look, that the best attack are going to win.
OK, we've won 3 so far. Not all of them convincing wins. How dangerous are the French, Fiona?
wildly. Listen, I suppose when you consider the French team, you have the Dupont and Entemac pairing is reinstated. And with the return of Pinot on the wing, there's absolutely no doubt as to that threat that's possessed by that French backline. But really what's really interesting about this French side is, you know, you talk about the sheer size of their pack, and in order to launch your attack, you have to gain the ball and you have to retain it. And actually, if you consider France, after three games, they are the team with the highest line-out success rate and the best scrum success. And we'll whisper, Ireland is currently the worst. And really, that French pack dominate the collisions. And it's the thing that allows that French, you know, fluid game that we know, that jouet or that, you know, desire not to let the ball go to ruck is the thing that allows this French side to be just so dangerous.
You're making us feel despondent in some
way. No, I'm nervous.
The way they lost to England, that has to be in the back of their minds as well, isn't it, the French?
I think so. Look, the question always with the French is which French side shows up. You know, if you consider that swing in their last two games, on their last day out, they beat Italy 73-24. But the previous game to that, they lost England by a point. You imagine you'll face a buoyant French side.
Okay, what are the upsides to us, apart from Lanzad Road in full throat singing, I presume?
Look, from an Irish perspective, look, you've three test centurions in Peter O'Mahony, in Keane Healy and in Conor Murray, and they're going to play their final game at the UBB on Saturday.
Yeah, it's going to be emotional.
Ahead of their retirement, absolutely. And look, as you say, inevitably it brings an emotional edge, and it's a really, really important day for them and for their families and for their clubs. And look, I think Andy Farrell and now Easterby seem to be able to, you know, harness those moments, you know, carefully. Though you'd have to say, I don't think the French are going to care. From an Irish perspective, they won't be delighted with their two previous performances or the three previous performances, and they'll know that they'll need, you know, a collectively brilliant performance in order to beat this French side. Yeah. And look, that's the bit that's reassuring about Ireland is that in the last few years, we haven't relied on two or three players constantly needing to perform because we have such quality. And that's the difference. We're eking out performances or eking out wins, even when our performance maybe isn't brilliant.
So we shouldn't despairingly look at the lack of
Tadhg
Furlong or, you know, McCants. No Gary Ringrose either through suspension.
I know. Look, I think from the centre point of view and the loss of Gary, you know, you've Aki and Henshaw are a perfect pairing. That's not a huge concern. It's unfortunate not to have Mac Hansen, and Jamie Osborne gets the nod there. I think Calvin Nash maybe is carrying an injury. And look, that's a big game for him, and defensively he's going to be under pressure against Beebury. You'd miss Tadhg Furlong in the scrum, and I think, look, there's a lot of discussion about the 7-1 split. So France have chosen
to have seven
forwards on their bench and one back, and the whole argument for that is that they then bring on a totally fresh pack after 50 minutes, and that allows them to dominate those collisions, and you feel you'll miss Tadhg Furlong from that scrummaging point of view and from that experience point of view.
We're 6-2 on the bench, and it's 7-1, isn't it? Come here, what's this we're hearing about Thierry Henry sticking his hand once again?
Apparently Thierry Henry was in the French camp this week, hopefully not inspiring any form of tomfoolery, but apparently he was in to talk to the French players.
Sticking his lava once again into Irish trees. This seems like a good point with French bitterness in our hearts towards the French. Let's bring in Le Bleu, Monsieur Benoit Lorge. He's a French chocolatier based in Kenmare in County Kerry. Comment allez-vous, Benoit?
I'm doing very well.
Good.
Hello to everybody.
Hello. Now,
I knew before the show that this story with Thierry Henry would come back on the table.
We won't
That's
ask you to explain
sentence,
it.
I say.
Come here, let's find out a little bit about you, Benoit, because you've literally spent exactly half your life, I believe, in France and half of it in Ireland.
That's right. 26 years in Ireland. I'm 52. Do the math.
And
as long as I've been in Ireland that I've been living in France.
How did you come to be here?
I came originally as a pastry chef, working in one of the 5-star hotels in Kenmare.
Oh.
Thinking that I will stay here for a year, and I just never left. Absolutely love the life here. Life is beautiful in Kenmare.
And you found love here?
And I found love.
Not with an
Irish woman, a Spanish lady.
A Spanish lady, okay. Yes, this is the centre of the universe. I believe you're an excellent pastry chef. Was it a local charity that asked you, a local charity for a playground, asked you to do something which kind of changed your life?
That's correct. You do your research, yes. I started originally when I was in Sinn Féin and using the kitchen in the winter for raising money for a charity for the playground. And we had a good response. And 2 years later, I decided to leave my job as a pastry chef and I set up a chocolate factory just outside Kenmare. And we've been in business now 20 years.
It's a dream. Lorge. And Fiona, you know Lorge chocolates.
Absolutely. I'm partial to them. They're absolutely beautiful. And I suppose my concern is if the French bring some of that flair that Benoit brings to his chocolates, we might be in trouble.
Thanks, Fiona.
Is business booming, by the way, Benoit, in the chocolate business?
Yeah, as I said, we've been 20 years in business, but now we are facing a big challenge with the cost of cocoa.
Oh, yeah.
The price of cocoa just been at the peak of history. So it is a bit of a challenge at the moment. But we carry on. We don't compromise on quality. And the order for Easter at the moment are pretty good.
Yes. Now, to rugby, Benoit, how big a fan are you of French rugby?
Oh, I am big now, but I discovered Ireland. I discovered rugby when I came in Ireland. In France, if you see, rugby is very popular in the southwest, and I'm from the northeast. So when I came to Ireland, I didn't know nothing about rugby. But along the years and about the fabulous decade that Ireland have been in the rugby, I really like became a big fan of it.
You had to go to Munster to discover rugby. Frenchman, that's perfect. Finally, we got one up on you. It is growing in France, though, isn't it, Benoit? Does everybody follow it now in France, or is it still more restricted than soccer?
No, I mean, soccer will be probably the sport number one. But as I said before, it will be really in the southwest. But now, after the emergence at a club like the Stade Français in Paris or the fabulous work that Roland O'Gara is doing with La Rochelle, it seems like it's moving a bit from different parts. So and the last few years, especially this year, like the French are playing a good rugby on my side. So the enthusiasm is there.
But you do, I presume you support Ireland maybe when France is not involved.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was in Cardiff 2 years ago wearing a green jersey and cheering up for Ireland.
Oh, fantastic. You can't be a blow-in when you're in a green jersey. Come here, I want to go back to that. Have the chocolate tastes of Irish people changed, Benoit, since you're serving us so well? Have we become more sophisticated?
Yes, much more, yes. when I start, the sales of milk chocolate compared to dark will be like 80 to 20. Now, 20 years later, I say to the Irish, I'm selling as much dark chocolate as I'm using, but I'm selling milk chocolate.
Really?
And as we know, dark chocolate is the real chocolate and the one good for you.
Because we would have been milk chocolate obsessed.
No. And even on the test of the flavor of the different fillings, they're much more adventurous. Like last week, we came out like with a Szechuan pepper and a lemon and basil and things that it will be difficult to sell a few years ago. And now I say people are curious to see some different flavor.
Yes. That's, I think we now have become the third biggest consumers of chocolate in the world per capita. Yes.
17 ton per person.
All down to you.
Yeah, I wish.
I better come back to the rugby. Fiona, it is a huge day. You mentioned the emotional stakes of the final home match, O'Mahony, Healy and Murray. Also 50th caps for three men as well, including the skipper.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, they're momentous occasions for those players. You know, Rugby Players Ireland have a tag that they're more than players, and that's what that is. Those days are a big personal achievement, but they from both perspectives, the French won't care, and the Irish are too professional to allow that to change. But it does bring an emotional edge, and I do think that's important. I think ultimately, whatever team starts better will potentially win. I think it's really going to be a massive decision. If France get ahead and they manage to launch their full bench, we might be in trouble. But if Ireland can keep themselves and start well, I think it could be just an absolutely smashing contest, and I think it's really going to be a score in the difference of the game.
A score in the difference? Oh my God.
Yeah.
By the way, the 50th caps, Caelan Doris, Beelam and Jack Conan are going to get their 50 caps. It's a Leinster heavy setup again, and I know you'd be biased, Fiona O'Brien, but are you sensing any lingering Munster bitterness that was there at the start?
I tell you, I'm not biased, actually. You'd be surprised. I'm actually a Munster woman who played for Leinster, so I actually am very balanced, I'd like to think.
Excellent.
Think, you know, I know the discussion always comes down at the moment to Sam Prendergast, and that's an ongoing discussion. Look, I think he had to be started considering they backed him for the last few games. You know, he had a man of the match performance against Scotland. I know he won't be as pleased with his performance against Wales, and there was a query over, I think he'd, you know, his tackle success was poor. And look, it's brilliant to have the talent of Crowley to come on if required.
we can technically lose tomorrow and still win the Six Nations, can't we? But obviously the
we
Grand
Slam. But absolutely. So the Grand Slam will be off the cards, but also there's a massive points differential. So at the moment, France have 63 points ahead. So they have a massive after their big win against Italy.
Oh, yeah.
So really, we don't want to leave ourselves in that position. Basically, we need to win.
Do you think we're going to win?
My heart says yes, but I'd say my head might say France.
Ah, don't say that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Don't like your head today. Benoit, how do you feel tomorrow?
Well, Ireland has got the home advantage.
Mm-hmm.
This game is definitely the tournament decider of the championship.
True.
Kylian Doris is back from injuries, which is good, but we've got also Ntamack and Damien Penaud back as well, which is a good thing. Now, as Fiona said earlier, depending on the French are coming up to the game, they are unpredictable. But even if I think that's a 50-50, I just think France is going to win.
Oh, man, that's practically two for France. Okay, well, hope you're wrong. And Benoit, thank you very much.
Too.
Merci. Bonne chance as well. You'll be busy in the run-up to the La Fête de Pâques, the Easter, so enjoy that. And I hope it thrives. And thank you, Fiona. And I hope you're wrong again this year.
Best of luck to the both of the team.
Bonne chance. It's live on RT2 television tomorrow, RT Radio 1, and on the RT Player. Kickoff at 2:15. You know it already. Hold your breath.